It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Glad you could be here. Republican lawmakers circulate bills to ban transgender women and girls from competing in female sports. We examine what the proposals would do with your questions and reaction. Call in along the way at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Democratic State Senator Mark Spreitzer of Beloit represents a South Central Wisconsin district and chairs the Wisconsin Legislative LGBTQ plus caucus. State Senator Spreitzer, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thanks for having me.
Good morning. So your colleagues across the aisle introduced bills that would ban transgender girls and women from participating in female sports at every grade level and in college. What is your reaction?
These are really harmful bills. We've seen them before here in Wisconsin. They were introduced last session where they passed the state assembly, but didn't make it through the state Senate because there was even Republican opposition. And Governor Evers has made clear that if they made it to his desk, he would veto them. But even just having these bills out there is harmful. And we've seen so many similar bills introduced around the country, including in places where they have become law. And a survey last year nationwide by the Trevor Project found that 86% of transgender and non-binary youth reported negative impacts to their mental health just from the existence of bills like these.
What is the goal of this bill? What's behind it from the authors?
The authors are trying to regulate who can play on which sports teams in both kindergarten through high school education, as well as college. And specifically, they're trying to restrict transgender women and girls from playing on women's and girls' sports teams.
Republican Representative Barbara Dietrich of Oconomowoc is one of the authors, and Dietrich says the bill would ensure women and girls have an equal opportunity to compete on a level playing field in athletics. What is your response to that viewpoint?
Well, that starts from the misunderstanding about who trans people are, because trans women and girls are women and girls. And so we need to start from the perspective of how do we make competition fair for everybody, including for transgender athletes. And we also need to remember that we're talking generally about athletics at a level that is not just about competition. You know, when we're talking about K-12 athletics, absolutely, competition is important, but so is the team building, the leadership development, the social development that comes along with that, the physical activity. There's a reason we have youth athletics, and it's not just to see who's the best. It's to have all of those opportunities for our youth to develop. And when we exclude transgender people from those opportunities, we're doing a real harm to them.
What about requiring schools to designate sports teams in three categories based on the sex of the students, male, female, or co-ed? Does the co-ed category help resolve your concerns about excluding transgender athletes from sports?
It doesn't. I'm all in favor of having co-ed sports opportunities. I think that's great. But if we end up in a situation where trans people are only allowed to play on the co-ed team and most of the other students are playing on gendered teams, we're really creating a system where trans people are excluded from what most of their peers are doing. And we know from history that separate but equal is not, in fact, equal. And this feels a lot like trying to create a separate segregated team for trans people. And I don't think that's going to be the right solution here.
We have Democratic State Senator Mark Spreitzer chairs the state legislature's LGBTQ plus caucus as we look at legislation targeting the rights of transgender people. And you can join in along the way with your questions, your comments on the legislation, 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. On Twitter, Governor Evers promised to veto the legislation if it's passed by the legislature. What message does the legislation send to people in Wisconsin, even with unlikely chances of becoming law?
I think, unfortunately, the legislation sends a message that far too many of my legislative colleagues don't understand trans people, don't support trans people, and are willing to actively discriminate against trans people. And I think that's a harmful message, especially to kids who are maybe figuring out their gender identity coming out and trying to make sure that they have a place in the world and in our state. So I certainly want to send a clear message, and I know Governor Evers is, that trans people and trans youth are welcome in Wisconsin, and that we're going to do everything we can to make sure that these bills never become law. And I'm incredibly confident that they're not going to become law this session.
Have you heard from constituents on these bills?
I have, and I've heard from constituents on both sides. I certainly have constituents who don't necessarily understand all of the nuances of what it means or what it's like to be transgender, and who have legitimate concerns about fairness in athletics that they've expressed. But I also hear a lot from both my own constituents and folks around the state who either are themselves trans or non-binary or are parents of trans or non-binary kids. Who are really concerned about not just this, but whether we're going to see other bills like we've seen around the country restricting access to gender-affirming healthcare or restricting trans people in public places. You know, there's just been such a wave of legislation around the country, and this could be just the tip of the iceberg. So I definitely hear from people who are really concerned about not just this, but what else might get introduced.
What about the piece about leveling the playing field? Is there any evidence that transgender women athletes have a physiological advantage?
You know, there are certainly issues that athletic organizations like the WIAA, the NCAA, and of course, groups around the country have been working through for years related to hormone levels when folks transition, and making sure that they have some fairness regulation in that regard. And I think letting those organizations continue to work on that level of nuance is appropriate. But, you know, they're one trans person is not the same as another in the same way that any other athlete is not the same as another. And, you know, we have to recognize in athletics, people do have different physical abilities. And I'm never going to be an amazing swimmer, runner, or football player. That's not my gift in life. And I think, you know, starting from the idea that somehow everybody is physically the same, that's not how athletics has ever worked. So, yeah, we have to look at things like hormones and make sure that there's fairness. But to exclude an entire group of people and think that that is somehow going to create fairness, that's just not right.
Let's bring on a call now. Rula is with us in Milwaukee. Hi, Rula.
Hi.
Hi, go ahead. What would you like to bring up?
Well, you know, I'm concerned about the mental health of the girls who have no chance to win this competition. The girls who have XX chromosome, they have no chance to win against girls with XY chromosome, because they are born with weaker body, less muscle mass. It's something that nature decided. We don't decide.
Rula, thank you for calling in. State Senator Spritzer, can you address that? We were just talking a bit there about the physiological differences.
Yeah, I mean, first of all, bringing up mental health is really appropriate, because the group that has far and away the most significant mental health challenges as youth right now are transgender and non-binary youth. And we see that rates of depression, rates of attempted suicide are much higher for trans young people. And so I think this is a really vulnerable population that we need to protect. But in terms of the mental health of other women who are competing in sports, first of all, I just don't agree that women are weaker or are not able to, you know, compete at the same level. I have friends who are women in athletics who, you know, one in particular that I'm thinking of do, you know, some pretty extreme weightlifting and bodybuilding and who are incredibly supportive of making sure that transgender women are able to compete alongside other women and who feel like they're ready to take on the competition. So I just think that that's not entirely accurate, and we need to protect everybody's mental health, and that means we need to figure out a way to treat kids as kids, to let kids play, and again, to really focus, especially at the middle school or high school level on the team building, the leadership development, the socialization, the physical activity, all of those benefits that come from youth sports. Very few people are going to end up being the best in the state or even the best in their school. And to those who are, you know, credit to them, they deserve to be celebrated. But most kids who play sports are not going to go on to professional sports. They're not going to go on to the Olympics, but they are going to have a great time. They're going to learn a lot. They're going to grow as a person. And I think that's the experience we want to protect for everybody.
Democratic State Senator Mark Spreitzer of Beloit chairs the state legislative LGBTQ plus caucus. There's room for your views on proposals targeting the rights of transgender people. Call in with the question, 800-642-1234. It's the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You have a line to State Senator Mark Spreitzer, a Democrat representing the 15th Senate District in South Central Wisconsin, chair of the Wisconsin Legislative LGBTQ plus caucus, as we look at Republican proposals to limit rights of transgender Wisconsinites. Call in with a question, share comments at 800-642-1234, email ideas at WPR.org. Stepping back for a moment, what are the legislative priorities of the LGBTQ plus caucus this year?
Thanks for asking. We have a number of bills that we've been working on for years, as well as hopefully a new one this year to try to achieve full LGBTQ equality across Wisconsin. So one that's already been introduced would ban the so-called LGBTQ panic defense, where someone who assaults or even murders a gay or transgender or other LGBT person can assert a panic defense that they essentially panicked and attacked that person because they were gay or trans. I think this first, became widely known when it was attempted in the defense of the murder of Matthew Shepard, and has become more common recently in the murder of trans people. So we want to ban that. But we also have a number of other bills that will be coming, most of which have been introduced previously, including protecting marriage equality, both in our state constitution and state statutes. Right now, it's only protected by U.S. Supreme Court decision. Updating our non-discrimination laws to fully protect gender identity and gender expression. Right now, they cover sexual orientation and sex discrimination, which we believe in courts have said protects transgender people, but we want to make that absolutely explicit. And we're also really hoping to ban conversion therapy, which is an issue that has gotten a lot of attention this session when our Republican colleagues blocked an administrative rule that would have banned it. We're trying to work to get bipartisan support for a state law change that would ban conversion therapy, which is when therapists attempt to change someone's sexual orientation or gender identity.
During a recent caller-only program, Valerie from Milwaukee called in to say, amid the circulation of anti-transgender proposals, people need to understand the experience of transitioning. And Valerie says it's a life-changing process. What do you think people should know about transitioning?
I think people should understand that it is not really optional, that for people who are transgender, transitioning and both figuring out how to live their life publicly consistent with their internal gender identity, to express that and to potentially transition medically, whether that's with surgery or hormones. Not everyone chooses surgery, but often hormones are incredibly important. That is really important to both the physical and mental health of people who are trans. And I've experienced that with one of my best friends from college, who ended up being the maid of honor in my wedding, came out as transgender after college. And, she and I had a ton of conversations throughout that process, and seeing who she's been able to be since she figured out that part of herself and transitioned is amazing. And, you know, watching her go through some of the difficulties that society threw her way during that process was really difficult to watch. But, you know, I've had a firsthand view of that, and it's just so important that people be able to access gender-affirming care, and that society and friends and family members support people as they're transitioning so that they can live their lives publicly as their true selves.
Let's bring on another call. Diane is with us in Jefferson County. Diane, hi. What would you like to share?
Good morning. I cannot thank your guest enough for all they're doing. It's reassuring me. I have a very close family member who's in her 20s and is trans, and honestly, she fears for her life. She has labeled this as genocide, and I totally agree. You had a caller just a little bit ago talking about X chromosome, Y chromosome, and people who are not educated in sports and things and transgender don't realize the number one success factor in sports is wealth. If you get to go to practice after school versus babysitting your younger siblings, you have a much better chance of success. But overall, I am thankful for Wisconsin. I am tired of these useless bills coming through when our children are being killed by guns at an extremely high rate that is unacceptable, and nothing is being done about that. So thank you so much.
Diane,
the bills you just discussed made my heart happy.
Diane, thank you for that call. I wonder, you know, what is your argument for why Republicans should work with the caucus on developing policies, you know, when they control the legislature? I mean, because you've just listed out a number of things that you're working on, and it's a large and wide body of work, of policy work.
You know, we've gotten bipartisan support in the past for some of these bills, for some of the ones related to marriage equality, the panic defense, and banning conversion therapy. Some of the ones that are more specific to protecting the transgender community, like the non-discrimination one, we unfortunately haven't yet gotten bipartisan support, because I think that's an issue, as we can see, that my Republican colleagues continue to need to grow on. But for where we have gotten bipartisan support, it's usually been a couple of legislators. We haven't been able to get public hearings and actually move things forward. But we're trying to grow that, because we know that there are Republicans who have gay family members, transgender family members, and oftentimes it takes that personal connection for somebody to maybe change their views and be willing to do something. So we're going to continue having those conversations one-on-one with our colleagues and try to build support. And of course, try to build public support. I understand that protecting the rights of transgender athletes is not perhaps the majority opinion in Wisconsin right now. Polling certainly shows that. But not that long ago, my marriage to my husband was not the majority opinion in Wisconsin. We actually had a vote to ban that in the Constitution back in 2006. And yet public opinion on marriage equality has changed dramatically. And public opinion on transgender equality is changing dramatically as well. But we still have a ways to go.
Talking about transgender rights with Mark Spreitzer, Democratic State Senator representing South Central Wisconsin and chair of the legislature's LGBTQ+ caucus. Let's turn to gender-affirming care. Governor Evers recently vetoed a measure in the state budget bill that would have blocked Medicaid coverage for gender-affirming health care. Is the state providing adequate health care for people transitioning?
I think we can do better, but fortunately, there have been a number of court cases that have required both Medicaid and state employee health insurance, as well as private insurance under the Affordable Care Act, to provide gender-affirming care on an equal basis when it's medically necessary. So I think there's more we can do to codify that, because right now a lot of that is relying on court decisions, and the state did not always provide that care. But I'm also concerned about about whether or not there are providers out there that are willing to provide care. Unfortunately, just this past Friday, SSM Health announced that they were no longer providing gender-affirming surgeries, and that's really incredibly disappointing. Gender-affirming care saves lives, and unfortunately, you know, they bowed to some pressure, it seems like, to stop offering care that they had previously offered. So we need to continue to provide state pressure and public pressure for health insurers, for hospital systems, doctors, to make sure that they're providing the care that folks need.
How would you shore up, you know, health systems that are moving away from these offerings, from these medical offerings, very quickly here?
The comprehensive non-discrimination bill that we're advocating would include non-discrimination protections within the healthcare system.
Hmm. State Senator Spreitzer, thank you for joining us.
Thank you so much for having me.
Senator Mark Spreitzer, Democrat representing the 15th Senate District in South Central Wisconsin, chair of the legislature's LGBTQ+ caucus. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is a State Capitol Report on the Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine litigation now, challenging the State Department of Natural Resources' authority to limit the release of manure from large farms that could end up in Wisconsin's waterways and in our drinking water. You can be part of the discussion about these regulations. Call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Sarah Walling is Water and Agriculture Program Director at Clean Wisconsin. Sarah, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Good morning. Thank you for having me.
Good morning. The law firm affiliated with the Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce suing the DNR and saying the department lacks authority to regulate large animal farms. Can you explain what the litigation argues?
Sure. So the Manufacturers and Commerce's Litigation Center is representing the two different dairy interest groups in our state, the Wisconsin Dairy Alliance and Venture Dairy Cooperative. And in their lawsuit, they are challenging the legality of the DNR's rules that oversee and provide the regulatory oversight to our state's largest livestock operations. And those are the ones that house about 1,000 animal units. And so for a dairy farm in our state, that means that they have over 750 milking cows on their facility. So farms of that size are generally referred to as concentrated animal feeding operations, or CAFOs. And this lawsuit challenges the DNR's authority to require those operations to apply for and receive a permit to operate once they hit that 1,000 animal unit threshold.
And so how does the state regulate large animal farming operations? What is the status there on CAFOs?
Sure. So the requirement to apply for and receive a permit happens at that 1,000 animal unit threshold. And the problem is that this permit is much more than just a piece of paper giving them the approval to be there and operate. The permit requires the farm to meet a set of standards for how the facility is constructed and how it operates, including how the vast amount of manure that they're generating is being managed. So how it is being stored, how and when and how much is being spread on the crop fields and whatnot. And those standards are there and intended to reduce the contamination that can be caused by manure runoff into our groundwater or surface water. So we're talking about nitrogen and phosphorus contamination here, but also certainly pathogens that can be carried within that animal manure. So what these dairy groups are instead trying to come with this lawsuit is to challenge whether or not DNR has the ability to require them to receive one of these permits.
So the permits requiring these farms that are large to get their manure storage and spreading systems approved by the DNR, Why do you think this is necessary to be for the DNR to be that involved in how an operation is handling this aspect of the dairy farm?
Well, the sheer number of animals that we're talking about when it comes to a CAFO, even at that very smallest level of 1,000 animal units, means that they're generating around 5 million gallons of manure each year. And that manure is being stored for long periods of time, usually in manure storage lagoons, and then being spread during certain windows of the year when the crops are off the field so that they can get in there and apply the manure. Now, manure is intended to be a really great nutrient source, but the problem is that when it's applied incorrectly or too much or at the wrong time, that's when issues can arise. And with this volume of manure that's being generated, you know, it's in our residents' best interest for our DNR to have some oversight and understanding of how those farms are operating, what they're doing with that manure, and making sure that they're utilizing it properly to reduce all of those potential impacts to groundwater and surface water systems.
You mentioned that the animal waste being stored in these lagoons or in these open ponds, is that a secure place for manure, or where does that ultimately end up if it's not spread on the fields?
Sure. So the majority of our largest farms do have these manure storage lagoons, and while there certainly have potential for them to be to overflow during times when they're too full, et cetera, there's a lot of precautions that are taken to when the construction of these systems to ensure that the leakage is at a minimum. However, you know, the majority of manure is being applied at certain times of the year. And so it's extremely important for the farm to really understand what their crop needs are, where they should go, where they need to avoid. So those nutrient management plans that govern the farm's application of manure over the course of a crop season are extremely important. And that's a huge component of what the permit process requires for these farms to operate.
Are all CAFOs operating under nutrient management plans? Are those plans filed, or you know, how does that work?
Yes. So currently there are 336 CAFOs that are permitted in the state. 74 of those are currently operating under an expired permit that needs to be reissued by the DNR. And 304 of those are CAFOs are dairies, and the rest of them are a combination of swine, poultry, and then beef cow CAFOs. They're in 62 of our 72 counties across the state. So this is, in fact, very much a statewide concern and issue. But when the DNR provides that permit, the process includes everything from, you know, plans and specifications that the DNR really looks at very closely to make sure that the facilities, the barns and the processing, the wastewater storage and handling systems are all constructed properly and being operated correctly. They also have to develop a response plan that is there in case a manure or a non-manure spill should happen so that they are prepared to deal with that reality. And then that nutrient management plan includes the manure that's, you know, being spread. It has to be spread in certain distances away from drinking water wells and sinkholes and fractured bedrock. Liquid manure can't be applied in frozen or snow-covered ground situations. Solid manure can't be spread in the similar situations. So it's very important that the farm really takes a very comprehensive look at how they're going to be handling that manure to make sure that it's done in the most possible, you know, the safest possible way.
It sounds very detail-oriented, plans like this.
They can be, that's for sure. And as the farm gets bigger, they get more complicated. Mm-hmm. And that's the reality of, you know, of large scale agriculture, animal agriculture in our state. And as such, you know, we believe that nutrient management plans and this permit process are extremely important to the oversight of these largest farms.
Sarah Walling with us, Water and Agriculture Program Director at Clean Wisconsin, as we talk about a lawsuit challenging our state's ability to regulate large animal farms. You can join in the conversation, call in with a question, share a comment at 800-642-1234. Sarah, Clean Wisconsin wants these regulations to remain, as you just pointed out, but could the regulations be eased in any way to relieve the burdens on these farmers?
Well, I think there's certainly opportunities to take a look at the permit system that we have in place and identify where there's opportunities to streamline things or reduce some of the, you know, the bureaucratic burden of the process. However, you know, this is not extremely different than what our neighboring states are doing relative to permitting for their largest animal feeding operations, too. So Minnesota has a state level system that is quite similarly in Michigan, Ohio. So while they might not have the WPDS permit, which is a specific one that we use here in Wisconsin, they all have something very similar, which includes a great deal of the same level of oversight and complexity that our state process and program provides.
Can you explain what risks large animal farms pose to water resources?
Sure. Well, it's, you know, the issues with manure are there, whether, you know, small, medium, and large farms. However, again, the amount of manure that we're talking about with these large farms really is what makes it more complicated. There's just a lot of manure that's being stored. And so during about 4 to 5 weeks, 6 weeks, maybe in the spring, and then similarly in the fall is when the majority of that manure is going out. And the time periods that that manure is being applied, especially in the spring, data from many different researchers at the university and discovery farms have identified that that's the riskiest time of the year to put it out, because we do get those really quick, flashy spring rains that have a tendency to, you know, wash things off of especially steeper fields. And so making sure that the manure is being applied at the right rate, the right time, the right method is all extremely important. And, you know, it sounds complicated and it's not, you know, certainly not simple, but it's really not undoable either. And many, many of our farms are already engaging in this, whether they're small, medium, or large farms. And this permit system that's being challenged through this lawsuit really just provides the structure of oversight for those largest farms to make sure that the DNR really understands what they're doing, how they're operating, and between them and land conservation department staff at the county level can assist the farms in making sure that they're making the right decisions about what to do with this manure nutrient and use it to the best of its ability without really risking the impacts to our surface water and groundwater systems.
When you say they're small, medium, and large farms, is it an accurate assumption then that we single out CAFOs, that we assume that CAFOs cause pollution?
Well, there's a recognition through the Clean Water Act that these largest farms do have the potential to discharge. And so there's a lot of, you know, constructs in place around the EPA's process that we implement at the state level. And that's the permit system that is being somewhat challenged here. But again, you know, the amount of manure we're talking is really what makes it the most challenging and the most risky for our public and environmental health concerns, because we're talking, you know, one CAFO can generate as many as 5 million gallons of manure each year. And that is essentially untreated. You know, it goes into these manure storage lagoons, sits there for several months until the time is right for them to be able to take some out and apply it to the fields. And so because it's so much, it takes a great deal of land base to be able to apply this manure properly, that it can be challenging to do that and to find the right times and the right openings and the right places. And so the program really is intended to make sure that there is that oversight and that, you know, CAFOs understand all the constructs underneath which they need to operate. It's really important just to setting sort of a level playing field for them. And, you know, this, in many ways, we're not treating CAFOs any differently than we are any of our other large industrial waste generating industries in the state. Our wastewater treatment plants that treat human waste certainly have to have these types of permits. Everyone from food processors, paper mills, etc., all of those big industries also have to have pollution discharge system permits. And they might look a little different because it's industrial waste and not manure, but the construct is the same. And so in reality, we're really not treating these large farms that are generating huge quantities of a waste product any differently than we are operators in those other types of industries in the state.
Other types of settings. Sarah Walling directs the Water and Agriculture Program at the Environmental Justice Group Clean Wisconsin, looking at litigation about regulating manure discharge on farms to protect water. Call in with a question or a comment, 800-642-1234. This is the State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is the State Capitol Report on the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The litigation arm of Wisconsin's largest business group sues the Wisconsin Department of Natural Resources on behalf of dairy farms and rules to keep manure out of waterways. Sarah Walling leads the Water and Agriculture Program at Clean Wisconsin and stays with us. Let's take a call now. Dina joining us near Keeler. Dina, hi. What would you like to add?
Hi. I lived in Iowa for over 20 years. My father-in-law ran a third-generation farm outside of Cascade, Iowa. And Wisconsin basically adopted Iowa's CAFO siting rules. And anyone familiar with what's happened in Iowa knows that Iowa's waterways have become toxic. They're dumping water into the Mississippi River that's affecting all the folks downstream in New Orleans. Art Cullen and his brother published a whole investigative series on the issues known as Storm Lake and won a Pulitzer Prize for it. Nothing has changed. A recent book called Swine Republic has been published by Chris Jones, a former professor from Iowa State, that looks at the issues. These things are not being regulated properly. It's nice to talk about it. But there's a CAFO right outside of Stitzer, Wisconsin, that it got approved and is built on a known sinkhole. And we talk about cleaning up stuff. We've got the Fox River Valley paper mill cleanup of the waterways there. These CAFOs are owned frequently by big corporations that don't care.
Dina, I want to toss this over to Sarah. You know, Dina there sharing what is happening in Iowa. Sarah, what's your response?
Well, you know, our water quality issues in the state are, you know, not all that different than what Dina described. You know, we have had some significant water quality challenges, you know, with over 10% of our public our private drinking water wells out there in rural areas being contaminated with nitrate above the, you know, health standard for nitrate. I can certainly appreciate the concerns that she brings forward, and it's definitely something that we're fighting against too. And, you know, that's one of the concerns certainly with this lawsuit is, while our oversight system itself for the largest farms might not be perfect, it's what we have right now. And by removing it, taking it away, as would be the outcome if this lawsuit was successful, is obviously moving us in exactly the opposite direction. And one of the things that I can say about the CAFO permit process and program right now is that it provides DNR, the public, and the land conservation departments, who are even closer on the ground to them, with knowledge about what the operations are doing, how many animals they have, where they're storing it, et cetera, and provides an opportunity and an ability for them to go in and do inspections and do, you know, some manure application reviews and whatnot to make sure that they're being done properly. And oftentimes, and I think it's the case in Iowa and certainly is here in Wisconsin, that the DNR's CAFO program is just exceedingly understaffed to really be able to provide the kind of oversight that the program and I think, you know, the state and people like us intend and hope that it's able to do. So, you know, this lawsuit is a really big threat because it would obviously move us backwards in that, you know, we want to be moving forward, providing more oversight and, you know, more ability to really understand what the farms are doing and make sure that they're complying with their permit requirements and not the other direction.
Let's go to Madeline now in De Pere. Madeline, hi, what's on your mind?
Well, I'd just like to say that these large farms with so many animals are not good for any of the creatures, not animal or human. The only creatures that benefit from these large farms are the Wall Street investors. And God never intended these animals to be caged up like that. They're not zoo animals, and they're supposed to be allowed to graze out in the open field and not be create such problems. And so I really hope that the people in Wisconsin will support politicians who insist that they limit the size of these animal farms.
Madeline, thank you. Sarah, are these animal farms getting bigger and bigger?
We have seen a lot of consolidation over the last 10 years. You know, we've seen a number of farms drop. However, the number of animals that we have in the state, especially when it comes to our dairy cows, has not changed. So what that means is that as smaller farms are going out of business for a multitude of reasons, the animals that they were housing are going to larger farms. So, you know, that is the case. Our CAFO numbers have been growing, but again, they're only 336 out of our over 6,000 plus farms in the state. And so, yes, there's a number of different ways that these farms can and could be operating, and including pasturing some of those animals and whatnot. But the CAFO model is there to, you know, it does allow, for good or bad, to have a really low cost way of producing animal products, in our case, often milk in our dairy industry. So while we see a lot of consolidation, we also see a lot of innovative farmers and a lot of beginning farmers coming in who do want to operate differently. And that's very encouraging.
Sarah Welling with us, Water and Agriculture Program Director at Clean Wisconsin. Sarah, what steps can animal farmers take to prevent polluting water?
I think, you know, their biggest tool is developing a nutrient management plan and working with conservation agronomists or technicians at the land conservation departments to really understand what the sensitive areas on their farms are, and how to avoid any runoff, you know, that could be caused around those. So to the caller's point, where if there's sinkholes or where there's really steep slopes or where you're very close to our streams, rivers, and lakes, there are different ways that you can manage that manure to really reduce the risk. And a nutrient management plan is your first step in doing that assessment. And a lot more farms are really gravitating toward agricultural conservation efforts just like that, and are working with agronomists and others to make that happen. And that's a really positive sign that the agriculture is really taking, in many ways, control of and responsibility for what their operations are doing, and want to leave their farms for their next generation to operate. And so groups like ours, but certainly many others across the state, as well as our state agencies, are working really hard to assist farms to achieve a high level of environmental sustainability. And, you know, we're happy to see that. So again, you know, lawsuits like this really impede that kind of progress and limit the conversation and ability to really highlight what else the farms are doing out there in our state right now to reduce their risk of environmental impacts.
How could Wisconsin's regulations of animal farms be strengthened? What would be a step forward that you see?
I think more requirements around who has to have nutrient management plans would be very important. And then really, I think a lot of it has to do with staffing and having that oversight and be able to go out and, you know, do some on-farm audits of what's going on and make sure that, you know, everything that's being described in the nutrient management plan and how the manure is intended to be stored and handled and applied is being done correctly. I think that level of oversight can really go a long way.
Sarah, thank you for joining us.
My pleasure.
Sarah Walling is Water and Agriculture Program Director at Clean Wisconsin. And you can check out our program page to find more conversations on this topic and others from the morning show. Visit WPR.org/mornings. This is a State Capitol Report. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to the morning show here on the Ideas Network.